Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
And I think it would be pretty dumb and pretty clueless and pretty tone deaf to try to act like today is just another day to talk sports. I understand why you might want that. I understand why you might be seeking an escape. But this is not the time for that. When it comes to the issue at hand, there has been too much escapism and too many diversions for some people. So here is what we are going to do. I mentioned the three guests. They're already booked. We're going to do those interviews. But we're going to do something else as well. Something that is much bigger than sports. I want to talk about George Floyd. I want to talk about Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and Eric Garner and Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and Freddie Gray and Walter Scott and so many more. You've heard these names before, and now we hear them once again. The thing is, you probably haven't heard the countless other names of black men and women who have been killed by police officers. When Atlanta Hawks head coach Lloyd Pierce was on this show last week, we talked about the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin and Pierce's reaction to it.
It's an emotional one, to be honest with you. What a tough week this has been for me personally, for African-American men, and I really think for our country. It's not right. The incident that happened in New York where the man at the bird park brought out his camera, and the incident that occurred where the lady accused him of assaulting her in a park and premeditated the accusation, was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life as a black man. It's literally like watching someone accuse you of something and then having the power to make it happen. And that's the reality. And the very next day you wake up and the reality is a man was killed for no reason. And so when you put the two together, you're afraid that you've become a threat just for the skin of your color. And then the reality is, because of the skin of your color, there's a chance that your life can be taken. And so I posted that picture, and I zoomed in on my face, and I had to explain this to a lot of people. If I zoom out, you say, oh, that's Coach Pierce. When you zoom in, you just see my face, and you just see a black man. And I become just that, just the black man. And a black man is in fear right now. And so it's been an extremely tough week for me personally. Because of just that, I'm not an NBA head coach. I don't have any privilege. I am a black man, and that's not going to go away. The NBA head coach could. The fear of being a black man could go away, but it isn't. It hasn't. And right now, it's at its worst point. So this has been a very tough and emotional week for me personally.
Lloyd, I want to make one more point, too. I want to read part of your post again so the people can really hear it. Quote, to think hashtag justice for Floyd could easily be hashtag justice for Lloyd, and it's because we look alike to those who discredit our existence. What does it feel like to know that that hashtag could have your name instead of his?
Sometimes you say the reality is it could happen. I think it's almost at this point the inevitable. This is no longer a one-off. It hasn't been for a while. It isn't a one-off. You know, these aren't just happening randomly. These are happening often. These are happening consistently. You know, the last one just happened to be in Minnesota. The next one could happen in Atlanta or could happen in L.A. I don't know. And who knows who it's going to be. But it's no longer just a reality. It's almost an inevitable that it's going to happen. That's why I put the tag. You know, it's not just because we have similar names. It's because we are black. And to some, that's all it needs to be. And that's what's scary.
So there's no way that you can hear that interview and not be moved, because it was Pierce speaking as a black man and not as an NBA head coach. As he said, the title of NBA head coach could fade at some point, but he will always be a black man in America. And for his entire life and lifetimes that have preceded him, that's meant the feeling of safety, of being protected. That's not an option for him. Now, here's the thing. As moved as I was by that conversation, I could not personally begin to comprehend what that might feel like. I have no idea what it feels like to live with that every single day. To know that you're never safe. To know that if the worst does happen to you, there is little chance of justice. So I cannot pretend to speak about the experience with any authority at all. I can only speak about my experience. And I'm a white man, and I'm looking to speak in particular to other white men right now. You might be tempted to turn off your radio or to change the station, but please don't, because you and I need to have a conversation. Now, it might not be a pleasant conversation. It might not be an easy conversation, but it's a very necessary conversation. I can't speak to the experience of Lloyd Pierce, but I want to try to speak to my experience. And I know a lot of you listening right now share a similar experience. Again, I am just a guy with a sports radio program. I am not an expert by any stretch. But let's acknowledge some facts, some tough facts, some things that might be painful to confront. As white men in America, we have things easier than most. It doesn't mean we have it easy, but we have it easier. This is a system that's been designed by and run by white men. I've worked very hard to get where I am. But the fact is, it's been easier for me to get where I am than it would be if I had different skin color. That's really not up for debate. We all know that. Again, it doesn't mean that it's easy, and it doesn't mean that I didn't work hard. But it's easier than if I had been born in a different zip code and had a different skin color. George Floyd died a week ago after being handcuffed and pinned to the ground by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Is there any doubt in your mind that if George Floyd looked like me, he would still be alive right now? Is there any doubt in your mind that if it was my neck that that officer was kneeling on, that he might have reacted differently if I was the one who said, "I can't breathe"? But I never have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about police brutality in that way at all. That's not a part of my life or my experience. I don't carry decades of that tension and fear in my body. I don't have to talk with my sons about how they should act if they're pulled over. And I don't have to live in fear every night that they may not come home because of a traffic stop that went badly. And I would imagine a lot of you listening right now are in the same boat as me. So when you see George Floyd lying on the ground and you're watching him struggle to breathe, if you are white, you and I know that we'll probably never have to live in fear of that happening to us. But just because it isn't happening to you doesn't mean it's not happening. And just because it's not happening to you doesn't mean you and I don't have a role in preventing it in the future. Too many people have died. These men and women are not statistics. They're people. Tamir Rice didn't get to celebrate his 13th birthday. Michael Brown was 18. His family never got to see him fulfill his potential. And neither did the rest of us. We all lose when this happens. But because it doesn't directly happen to us or someone who looks like us, it's too easy to just look the other way and to say, "Well, that's too bad. Something has to change." And then we keep right on going on with our lives. Or worse, it's too easy to look at the protests that have happened around the country and see them as problematic, instead of seeing them for what they are. The protests are not the problem. Continued police brutality is. So if your reaction is to say that you wish that people would protest the continued killings in a different way, I would suggest you check in on your thoughts about Colin Kaepernick, because he peacefully protested police violence. And then what did that get him? A lot of people freaked out, and he ultimately paid the price with his career. And this is exactly what Kaepernick was protesting against. Colin Kaepernick placed one knee on the ground to protest police brutality. Derek Chauvin put one knee on the back of George Floyd's neck. Side by side, the comparison could not be any more clear. So if your reaction to the protests is, "Yeah, well, what about the looters?" then you've completely missed the point. And probably you're doing it intentionally. don't waste my time or anybody else's with what about the looters. Of course nobody is defending looting. But don't confuse the looters and the protesters. And if you really want to get into a discussion about behavior that led to immoral gains, if you really want to have that conversation, we could talk about slavery, convict leasing, Jim Crow, and redlining, to name a few topics. In other words, why would you be more worried about a target than all of that? Again, I want to reiterate, I'm just a guy with a sports talk radio show. I am not a sociologist. I am not an expert. I'm not a politician. I'm certainly no expert in police reform. I don't have any great plans. But here's what I do know. What we as white men in particular have done to this point to end police brutality and institutional and systemic racism is not enough. We need to do more. We need to do better. You see, we know this is happening. This is not new. You and I know this. We've known this for a long time. But it's been easy to look away because it hasn't been our problem. And we haven't been affected by it. But the truth is, it is our problem. Maybe Rodney King was your first exposure to it. That was nearly 30 years ago. But this problem goes back further than that. This is not something that started recently. What started recently is people have video cameras and they have phones and they can capture it. And yet capturing one death after another on video doesn't seem to have changed anything at all. There are almost never consequences. A family and friends are left mourning the tragic killing of a loved one, and millions are left to wonder why there never is any justice. So here are a couple of more things that I'm thinking about, and I hope you are too. It's not enough to claim that America is post-racial. It isn't. It is not enough to claim that we're colorblind. We aren't. And generally speaking, the vast majority of people who claim to be colorblind are white. And it's not enough to say that we aren't racist. We need to be anti-racist. We need to be actively fighting against racism. We need to be calling it out. We need to be looking at ourselves and seeing what conscious or unconscious bias we hold. We need to be holding our friends accountable when they say or do racist things. We need to be learning about institutional racism and identifying it. We need to be learning about structural racism, identifying that and taking it down. It's not enough to just encourage people to vote. We need to be making sure that people have the ability and access to vote. Like, tragically, none of this is new. But what can be new is how you and I respond to it. I am going to try. I invite you to come along. This is not going to be easy, but it's going to be worth it. Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those most in need. To help, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who help us all. If you're hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your front line. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and the experience that you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, visit LinkedIn.com/Rome, LinkedIn.com/Rome. Terms and conditions do apply, LinkedIn.com/ROME. Kelly Rudy is my guest. Kelly, it's been a while, but it's great to have you back, and there's a lot that I want to talk to you about. But before we get into it, how are you and your family doing in the middle of this pandemic?
We're doing okay, Jim. I think you might know, if you follow me on social media, that one of my big things that I like to talk a lot about is mental health. And so we've been on top of that in terms of all of our family, our kids. We're grandparents now, Jim, and so life looks a little bit different. But, yeah, we're doing okay. Thanks for asking. I hope that you and your family and your friends are all okay. And, you know, it was really nice to get the invite because I was thinking about it, Jim. I don't know if you'd remember, but my first time on your TV show was October of 1989. I had just been traded to L.A. in February of that year. We went through the playoffs. We lost in the second round, and I was lucky enough to have an invite from you to go on your TV show to start that NHL season, and Bruce McDowell, our owner, drove me to your studio. So we go back a long, long time, my friend.
Oh, Kelly, that's amazing. What an amazing story that is. Bruce McDowell drove you to the studio. Now, I remember those days very vividly. Those were great, great days. And I did want to catch up with you, Kelly. And when you mentioned mental health, that really is the reason, aside from you and I haven't spoken in a long time, but that is the reason I want to catch up with you, because in addition to your work as an analyst, you were also a mental health advocate. It's a role that you've taken on that you've been very public about. If we were to go back to that time, you told the LA Times that before the 92-93 season, Kelly, with the Kings, you started to deal with mental health challenges. What were you feeling at that time, and what were you dealing with?
All right. So, first of all, I had no idea what mental health issues were, and so I didn't know what was going on. I thought this was a normal brain talking to myself about all the issues that I was feeling, and what I was feeling is that I thought my career was coming to an end. You know, I had known all the stats before that, that most NHL careers are ballpark in around 3 years, and I was to find out later, Jim, that of all the guys that have ever played in the National Hockey League, 49% of all the players play 50 or fewer games. I didn't know that stat at that point, but it just tells you how short a career most likely will be. And so my brain was telling me that I couldn't keep this up anymore, I couldn't play at this level any longer, all these negative thoughts. And so I started the season, Jim. You'd remember that that was the year in which Gretzky was injured to start the year. But we got off to a great, great start. I had maybe my best start, even though I was struggling with all these thoughts. But it came crashing down when we were in Milwaukee for one of those neutral site games right at the end of November. And I had an episode the night before the game in my room. I had ordered room service and just a Pepsi or something, and the thoughts were louder and louder and louder, and somehow I was able to get through the night and play the next game, and I actually had one of my better games of my career. We beat Chicago 4-3, I believe, and we went home, and I had a couple more good games, but then I went right in a ditch in a hurry, and I literally thought that I would never play again and that I was the worst goalie in the National Hockey League. So I couldn't any longer control my thoughts, and luckily for me, Barry Melrose recognized I had an issue and I had some problems, and he recruited his good friend Tony Robbins, so I was able to work with Tony and Barry, and they're able to get me out of that really dark place and lonely place, and I was able to play not only the rest of the season in which we went to the finals, but I played another 5 years. So whenever I tell or see Barry, I tell him I'm forever indebted to him.
Kelly Rudy is joining us. You know, it's an amazing story, Kelly, and it's so great that Barry Melrose was your coach at that time. I mean, from the outside, Kelly, people have the impression that hockey players are so tough, and they are, and they can face down anything. Like, at that time, what was the culture like in the game if you wanted to talk about mental health?
Oh, it wasn't a very lively conversation, I can tell you that, because I know that some of my teammates were very skeptical of Tony and the work that he was doing with myself. And even afterwards, when I became healthier, I could see some of the guys were on board and they were happy and they were grateful that I was able to get the help. But it was the following season, Jim, when I really recognized that this sort of work, it was not gaining a lot of traction. So our team was slumping again. And Barry once again recruited Tony, but not for me individually, but for our team. And so Tony was going to meet with all of us. And I could see there were somewhere around 12 guys that were extremely skeptical. And they went through the exercises, but I knew that it wasn't resonating whatsoever. So I think, Jim, this conversation, it may have started for me back then, but I don't think that it's really started to take hold. At least in my industry, until the last 7 to 10 years, when I think, and not just sports psychology, because we're talking about something different. We're talking about mental health issues, and that's a completely different field, in my opinion.
We're talking to Kelly Rudy, former NHL goaltender. You know, Kelly, when I started the conversation off, I said, how are you and your family doing? And you said, well, we're together and we're dealing with mental health, and that's part of the advocacy. Like, let me ask you about your daughter, Caitlin. Now, she was 11 years old, and she did not want to go to school or dance class. What do you remember about that time?
Oh, Jim, you warmed my heart, buddy, knowing all about Caitlin's story. So, well, I remember some of the most troubling times in our family's life, and Caitlin's life was completely debilitating. She couldn't, as you mentioned, leave the house. She couldn't go to school, couldn't go to dance, didn't want to be around her friends. You know, we partnered with a bank here in Canada a number of years ago when Caitlin came out in a big way in 2013 to tell her story Canada-wide. And that bank, the Royal Bank of Canada, had a sign. It was know the signs, and they had five different signs to look out for to check on somebody's mental health. Well, Donna and I, the night before the stories came out, I was in St. Louis doing a playoff game for Hockey Night in Canada, and we had a chat, and we came up with, I believe, 13 different signs that Caitlin had been exhibiting. Jim, we took them all as individual habits, maybe quirky habits, and we didn't put the entire package together. Had we done that, we would have been able to get Caitlin the help that she needed earlier, but I have no regrets about that, Jim. I did not know that trouble was lurking. I didn't know what mental health looked like. I didn't know that Caitlin was suffering. And by the way, oftentimes, and Caitlin is an example of this, when they're going through something, she was a really good liar. Like, she was trying to hide it like crazy. And so going back to those times, you know, I think of her when she was now 16 years old, and she started to tell us that she's now starting to have more good days than bad. So we put in a lot of work, lots of breathing exercises, all these other things, and man alive, it turned our world around, and we're so happy to have Caitlin and the work she does, mental health. I've told her many, many times, I've met a lot of really great, powerful people, but I think she's the strongest person I've ever met in my life.
What an amazing statement. Kelly Rudy is joining us. Kelly, just so the listeners are clear on this, Caitlin was struggling with anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder. She was diagnosed, but to your point, she went public with that diagnosis in 2013, and she received so much positive response. It was such a courageous thing for her to do. How much have you learned from Caitlin throughout the entire process?
Oh, boy. I can't tell you how much I've learned. It's improved my life. It's improved my wife's life. It's all of our family members. And Caitlin has, you know, she's been such a great advocate for talking about mental health. So many people, Jim, come up to her and us every single day, and that's not an exaggeration. And whether I get a text message, a phone call, an email, I bump into somebody in the local coffee shop, somebody comes up to us and shares their story. Now, the beautiful thing about this, Jim, once again, the night before she was going to go public, I had a great conversation with her about, do you really want to do this? Because I was so afraid of social media and the haters and the bashers out there. And I'm proud to say, and for your listeners that might be struggling and might be interested in getting some help, you will find only love and support. Caitlin had not one basher, not one hater, and nobody tried to embarrass her. Nobody tried to shame her. And so that's my story about this. You will find people will be so supportive, and there's nothing to be embarrassed about. You know, as you know, Jim, I live in Canada, and the Canadian Mental Health Association will tell Canadians that one in five Canadians will suffer, and I disagree with that number. I say maybe one in five, it's completely debilitating and they can't function. I say the number is closer to four in five or even five in five. We all have something.
And I lost Kelly Rudy momentarily. Kelly Rudy, with such a powerful message, why don't you see if you can pick that up? Adam, I want him to finish that thought. There's another question or two that I wanted to pose to him as well. Kelly Rudy is an analyst on NHL and Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada, and did play 15 years in the NHL, was the 38th pick overall in 1980, and had 217 career wins. And it does bring a smile to my face. I mean, this is a very serious and powerful subject as well. But I love that Kelly remembered that when he first got to L.A., he came on our TV show and that Bruce McDonald had driven him to the studio. And we are now saying that back up. Kelly, nice to have you back. Why don't you finish that thought? Yeah, you said that number one in five did not make sense to you, but more like four and five or five and five.
That's right, because I think we all have something in our own way.
Now, it's not debilitating, luckily, but we all have thoughts. We all think about things. We all have our own sort of anxiety, I believe, and but we're able to get through a day. You know, we might have our thoughts, and it's different for everybody, but and that's the thing I really want to encourage people to talk about, and it's don't go through it alone. Man, I did that, and that's not great. That's a hard way to do it. Caitlin has taught me a ton about talking about it, and our entire family talks about it. Like, our oldest daughter, Jessica, she is the mom to our little precious Maverick, our grandson. She's never experienced mental health issues until this pandemic, and it really got her, and it scared the heck out of her, and she had to deal with her thoughts and so on. My wife was so scared leading into this pandemic, and then when it sort of really started to rage, and then she ended up stressing herself up, Jim, and she ended up getting shingles. So this is something I believe that affects all of us, and luckily it doesn't affect us day to day or greatly, but we have to be on top of it.
Kelly Rudy is my guest. Kelly, before you go, I want you to share one more thought. You posted a video in April where you talked about the fact that it has not been easy and that there was a week where you just did not feel up to it. And then you put on a shirt that read, quote, "It's okay to not be okay," end quote. Why was it important to you to share that with people that not every day is an easy day? And what did you want people to take away from that message?
That it can affect all of us. And you're right. I was posting weekly videos, sometimes a couple a week. I was just stressed out with the pandemic and the thought of, you know, work and finances and all that stuff. And I thought, this is an important message. A friend of mine made those shirts up. As you mentioned, it's okay not to be okay. And I want to stand up in front of people and really share that it can affect everybody. If I can be on national television every single week, every single day, if I can get a message out there that I'm like you, you're like me, we're all in this together, please, please share. You know, it's not easy sharing, but it's really comforting to know that people react to that. I had so many positive reactions from that to the message, Jim, and this is one of them. I mean, you reaching out to me, and we're not even talking about the pause in the National Hockey League. We're talking about something far greater and more important in our lives.
No question, Kelly. That's why I wanted to find you. As I mentioned, I want to get caught up. You know, a couple of old friends talking, but it's such a powerful message. And I think that your family has displayed tremendous courage in going forward and sharing your thoughts and suggesting advice that you don't go about this alone and every day is not an easy day. You played 15 years in the NHL. Kelly, if there are people listening right now that are going through this and are not sure where to turn, where should they turn? Or if they want to reach out to you, how would they do so?
Well, for me, they can get a hold of me on Twitter or Instagram. Number one thing, also, talk to a friend, talk to a loved one, and or here's another idea, Jim. If you're somebody and you're around a family member or friend and you're looking at them, most likely you can tell by looking in their eyes that they may be struggling with something. So you should start the conversation, and maybe they won't be a part of it, but maybe they will over the course of time. And you should ask them something like, "Hey, how you doing? Are you okay? I sense that you might be struggling a little bit." Just gently sort of nudge the conversation in that direction, and you may be surprised that they may just say, "Yes, I'm not doing great."
Excellent message. An analyst on NHL on Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. Kelly, so great to get caught up. I really appreciate you, and I appreciate you coming on. I'm so glad we had that conversation, Kelly.
Same, Jim. I really appreciate the call. Thanks, buddy.
You know, a lot of teams and a lot of brands have released statements over the last few days. Most of them are fairly unmemorable. But then you have the Washington Wizards, and the players there released a statement on Twitter that is memorable. Quote, "We will no longer tolerate the assassination of people of color in this country. We will no longer accept the abuse of power from law enforcement. We will no longer accept ineffective government leaders who are tone deaf, lack compassion, or respect communities of color. We will no longer shut up and dribble." End of quote. You know, the days of shut up and dribble are over. In fact, they should have never existed to begin with. The argument that athletes should not speak out about social issues has always been a terrible argument. Telling athletes to stick to sports when they speak out about their own life experiences. Has never been about sticking to sports. It's been about ignoring what athletes have been saying. Like, it's been about plugging your ears and shouting down the life experience of the people you cheer for because their message makes you uncomfortable. It's got to be over now. It needs to stop now. Boston Celtic Jaylen Brown drove 15 hours from Boston to Atlanta to march in his hometown. Tobias Harris marched in Philadelphia. Members of the Minnesota T-Wolves joined former NBA player Steven Jackson on Friday. He spoke about his friend, George Floyd.
I'm here because they're not going to demean the character of George Floyd, my twin. A lot of times when police do things that they know that's wrong, the first thing they try to do is cover it up and bring up your background to make it seem like the bullshit that they did was worthy. When was murder ever worthy?
Never.
But if it's a black man, it's approved. You can't tell me when that man had his knee on my brother's neck, taking his life away with his hand in his pocket, that smirk on his face didn't say I'm protected. You can't tell me that he didn't feel that it was his duty to murder my brother and that he was fine with it, that he knew he was going to get away with it. You can't tell me that wasn't a look in his face.
There was more reaction. Others, Houston Rocket, Thabo Sefolosha, who suffered a broken leg and torn ligaments in an incident with the police in 2015, said that seeing the video of George Floyd brought back terrible memories. He said, quote, "I was just horrified by what I saw. That could have been me," end of quote. Michael Jordan issued a statement that read in part, quote, "I don't have the answers, but our collective voices show strength and the inability to be divided by others. We must listen to each other, show compassion and empathy, and never turn our backs on senseless brutality. We need to continue peaceful expressions against injustice and demand accountability. Our unified voice needs to put pressure on our leaders to change our laws, or else we need to use our vote to create systemic change. Every one of us needs to be part of the solution, and we must work together to ensure justice for all," end quote. Yesterday, Atlanta Braves legend Dale Murphy put forth a string of powerful tweets about his son's experience protesting in Denver. Dale Murphy tweeted, quote, "Last night my son was shot in the eye with a rubber bullet while peacefully protesting for justice for George Floyd. His story is not unique. Countless others have also experienced this use of excessive police force while trying to have their voices heard." He went on, quote, "Luckily, his eye was saved due to a kind stranger that was handing out goggles to protesters shortly before the shooting and another kind stranger that drove him to the ER. Others were not so lucky and will be permanently disabled due to excessive police force." The tweet goes on, quote, "As terrible as this experience has been, we know that it's practically nothing compared to the systemic racism and violence against black life that he was protesting in the first place. Black communities across America have been terrorized for centuries by excessive police force." Dale Murphy continues, quote, "If you're a beneficiary of systemic racism, then you will not be able to dismantle it at no cost to yourself. You will have to put yourself at risk. It might not always result in being physically attacked, but it will require you to make yourself vulnerable," end quote. That's Dale Murphy talking about the experience that his son had. So to me, the conversation right now does not need to be about what is and is not an appropriate form of protest. It needs to be about the issues that are being protested. It needs to be about the videos that we keep seeing, the lives that are being taken. It needs to be about the excessive use of force by police on black men and women and the fact that there really are rarely consequences. And those of us who only experience moments like this by watching our TV or going to our phones at this point need to do more than just merely observe. Those of us who are not directly impacted by this on a daily basis, those of us who do not have to deal with the fear that Lloyd Pierce or that caller from Oakland talked about, can do more and have to do more. I think Dale Murphy said it extremely well. If you're a beneficiary of systemic racism, then you will not be able to dismantle it at no cost to yourself. You'll have to put yourself at risk. It might not always result in being physically attacked, but it will require you to make yourself vulnerable, end quote. You know, and if you're one of those people, if you're one of those people who are tweeting now, that's it, Rome, now you've done it. I've been a listener for 20 years, not anymore. I'm going to say, all right, farewell. Farewell. Because we do have a challenge in front of us. And those of us who are comfortable need to be made to feel uncomfortable. Because if you're comfortable right now, this is the problem. If you're comfortable right now, that's the problem. We are joined right now by another friend of the program. He is a staff writer for the Washington Post. He is Robert Klemko. Robert, it's great to have you on as well. I know you've been in Minneapolis for the last few days. Robert, when did you arrive, and how would you describe what you've seen so far?
Yeah, great to hear from you, Jim. I arrived three nights ago, so that was Friday night, you know, touched down at 11 o'clock to support some of the other fantastic news reporters that were already here and photographers that were here, and went straight into some of the protests that were happening late that night down at the 3rd Precinct that had devolved into violence where they had set the precinct on fire. And so I've been here since then, you know, writing stories about some of the goings-on during the day and night, most recently profiled one of the activists who happens to have a connection to the sports world. It's, you know, Royce White, the former NBA first-round pick, who has now become a protest leader here in Minnesota.
In fact, Robert, I was going to ask you about that, and I will in one second. It's an important part of this story. I do want to ask you this, though. You were among the writers on a piece in the Post yesterday with the headline, "Minneapolis has become a war zone." What has it been like to witness all of this?
You know, I actually covered Ferguson a little bit for Time magazine when I was with Sports Illustrated, and we had that relationship with Time and that connection. And so I was down there working on a high school sports story and contributed to that. It's very different from that that experience because, you know, the violence at night here and the protests during the day and the protests at night are all over the city. And so you had a police force that was racing to cope with these tiny uprisings, you know, in South Minneapolis, at 38th in Chicago, where George Floyd was killed, at the 3rd Precinct, at the 5th Precinct, at the Viking Stadium, at the U.S. Bank Stadium downtown, you know, on I-35, where yesterday a truck drove through a protest being led down the highway. So you have this very global sense of unrest as opposed to something that's extremely isolated to one neighborhood. And in a sense, I think that's been reflected all over the country. I mean, you saw riots and protests and activism in 2014 and 2015 in the wake of, you know, multiple police shootings and killings, but you didn't see it on the scale that we're seeing now.
Robert Klemko is joining us. Robert, a few days back, somebody emailed you and told you, quote, "stick to box scores," end quote. What was your reaction to that email?
You know, we get that stuff all the time, and even more so now that I'm writing for the Post and that's what's illustrated, because our email address is at the bottom of the story, right? So it's easy. My answer to any of those people that say, you know, stick to box scores, to you or to me or to any sports writer, is that sports is politics. Sports is culture. Sports is business. Sports is law and order, crime and punishment. It's all of those things. I mean, it's almost impossible to go through your entire career as a sports writer without touching on any of those subjects. I happen to get more interested in that stuff as my career progressed, and now I'm working for the national desk temporarily covering the virus, covering these protests, you know, covering these killings. And, you know, I think we're all citizens and our interests are allowed to change, and I would never tell somebody who was a plumber that he shouldn't go vote. I mean, I would ask everybody to try to be well-rounded citizens.
Robert Klemko writes for the Washington Post. He's a friend of the program. So, Robert, you mentioned Royce White. Now, you were not looking for a sports story, but you found a story with that connection with White. I had him on the show, Robert, in mid-April. How did you first hear about this story and his involvement in the protests in Minneapolis?
Yeah, so I talked about like the global nature of these protests. At one point, we saw this group heading down Washington, which is, you know, a main thoroughfare here downtown. And they were right by our hotel, so we saw it out the window, and I just went outside and started following the group. I got to the head of it, and then everybody at the head of the group is 6'5 or taller. And this bald guy in a black suit and a white dress shirt leads this group to the middle of I-35 west at the Mississippi River crossing, and everybody kneels, and then he addresses them, and it was just this incredible magnetic presence this guy had. And so I introduced myself, had no idea who he was. It's Royce Light, you know, NBA draft, first-round pick, who, you know, had a cup of coffee in basketball, has this crazy story about, you know, this crippling anxiety disorder, not able to fly, and becomes a mental health advocate and now this activism leader in Minneapolis. So it was just, you know, pure dumb luck running into him. And this group of basketball players and athletes around Minnesota that started this protest with 200 people outside of U.S. Bank Stadium a couple days ago, 3 days ago, and ended up with several thousand crossing I-35.
So, Robert, to that point, why did that march start at the home of the Minnesota Vikings? That's not a coincidence, right? Why did they choose that location to start that march?
Yeah, you know, I asked Royce that, and he said that it was no mistake. The U.S. Bank Stadium, to him, is a symbol of, you know, the oppression that minorities face in Minneapolis and abroad. He said, you know, this place was funded by taxpayer money, right? Millions and millions of dollars of taxpayer money that private corporations should be paying for themselves, not taxpayers. And how much of that money could have gone towards police reform to make sure that things like the George Floyd killing don't happen.
We're talking to Robert Klemko. Robert, as you mentioned, he's dealt with some near crippling anxiety. What's your sense as to how he is doing in the middle of all this? And do you feel like this is a one-off for Royce White, or is this place and space for him? And could he really be a leader and continue forward doing this?
Yeah. You know, I think everybody's on edge, everybody's really anxious. I mean, people without anxiety disorders are really having a hard time in all this. The amount of people I've seen crying in the streets is, you know, more than I care to. So I think everybody's having a tough time, but Royce really feels at home in this, you know, moment in history because he is so well-read and he is so interested in the politics and of it all and the economics of it all. I think he could become a leader in this space. It is going to be tough, you know, if he wants to take that nationally and try to, you know, represent and lead in other cities if he won't fly, right, obviously. But this movement, you know, characterized by Black Lives Matter in the aughts in response to all of these cell phone videos that have come online, that have appeared online of police killings of African Americans, police abuse of minorities. It's been a movement characterized by a sort of lack of a figurehead, a lack of, you know, one leader that everybody can point to. And I think that that's been by design largely. You know, it's very much a grassroots effort. And I do think that limits a little bit of the reach of it, but it also, you know, protects them from relying on one individual to carry their message.
We are talking to Robert Klemko. He writes for the Washington Post. He's a good friend of the program. Hey, Robert, one of the things that comes up when talking about the protests, you, of course, have heard this. I hear this. We all hear this. The protest and the yeah, but part of this. Like, yeah, but what about the looters? What is your response when you hear, yeah, but what about the looters?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a bunch of different ways to respond to that. You know, the one thing that Roy said that was fascinating to me was, you know, people criticize the looting and the violence, but they don't actually want to see the refined version of that political emotion, which is African Americans, minorities openly carrying guns. So that's one way to look at it. You know, I think it's an expression of rage by people that don't feel like they have a voice. And that's in no way justifying it, but I do look skeptically upon anyone who is more upset by destruction of property and, you know, hits to the major insurance companies across the country than they are about, you know, the choking death of George Floyd.
We're talking to Robert Klemko for a few more moments. Robert, you mentioned that you also have been traveling the country covering COVID-19. Let me ask you about that. How would you describe what the last 2.5 to 3 months have been like for you?
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy, you know, to see kind of the devastation that virus has wrought across the country, you know, not only in a health sense, but also in an economic sense, and to see communities and states struggling to strike that balance between, you know, health concerns and financial concerns. It's been depressing, to be honest with you. The stories that really stick with me are about people that were already on the fringes. You know, I spent some time with the Navajo Nation, where 36% of people have running water, and they rely entirely on communities, you know, 1 and 2 and 3 hour drives away for fresh produce. They live in food deserts. You know, this virus has hit those communities especially hard, but it's also been inspiring to see, you know, the leadership in those places and also the outside donations that have come in to support those people. You know, I think any of us monitoring this, we all have the hope that, you know, we come out better for all of this and better connected after all of this.
He is a staff writer for The Washington Post. He is a good friend of the program, covering a lot of ground today with Robert Klemko. Robert, great to hear your voice. Always good to have you on the show. I appreciate you. And nice to get caught up, Robert. Thanks so much.
You're the best. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, again, it seems kind of weird to be talking about Lance Armstrong, of all people, today. But part two of whatever that documentary was did air last night, and I watched it, and I've got to say, it wasn't much better than the first. I mean, the episode itself starts off with Lance being asked the following question.
Do you feel like you want to be relevant again?
This is going to sound terrible, but I am relevant. I am.
I don't know if it sounds terrible. It sounds false. It sounds incorrect. The fact is, you're really not. You're really not relevant. The fact is, you competed in a sport that received minimal attention before you came along. Then you generated a lot of attention and a lot of buzz for that sport. But you built all of that attention and buzz on a lie. And now people really don't think about that sport or you anymore. Like, before this documentary, when was the last time you thought about Lance Armstrong for more than a second? And then after today, when will be the next time you think about Lance? And no, it doesn't matter that his athletic accomplishments were 15 years ago. The world just watched a 10-part doc on Michael Jordan's accomplishments, and they were 22 years ago. And people were riveted because he's still relevant, and you aren't. I mean, maybe relevant to yourself, but saying you're relevant is tone deaf. It's so in your own world. It's pure delusion. Just like this really weird semi-claim that being polarizing means that people talk about you. I mean, that's honestly not even true. I have a sports radio program. I talk sports for 3 hours every single day. And today will be the second time that I've talked about Lance in the last, I don't know how many years. And that was only in the first in a series of truly weird and bizarre moments in that documentary last night. There were some weird moments in that doc. Like that strange debate about Lance's work with cancer research and him talking about all the money he passed up so the money could go straight into his foundation. And then an extensive infomercial about the foundation and the impact it had. I mean, let's be honest about that. I don't know too many people who thought that he wasn't sincere when it came to working to raise money and raise awareness for cancer research, or the impact that he had on people who were diagnosed. Because that story gave people hope. The book gave people hope. The story gave people hope. It gave people a belief that not only could you beat cancer, but you could come out even better and stronger and tougher on the other side. That's what we thought. But that was built on a lie. That was built on doping and cheating. Because he wasn't telling people that he beat cancer and went back to doping. That part of it didn't come up. Only that he beat cancer and then went back on his bike and did all these things, these amazing things, and he was clean, but he wasn't. He was saying the exact opposite. He was using the, quote, cancer shield. He was reminding everybody that he beat cancer and that there was no way he would ever take PEDs or doping after that. Remember, he used to make that point. Why would I do that? Why would I do that? I nearly died. Why in the world would I dope or take drugs after going through something like that? Why would I jeopardize my health? Remember how hard he went with that argument. Not only why would he, but how dare any of you even ask him the question? How dare any of you even think that he would? And now he says, now, that he did use cancer as a shield and that it was bleeping stupid. His words. It was that for sure, but even worse. Just like his answer about how he would respond to his son, a football player at Rice, if his son went to him and said, I want to use PEDs.
How would you feel if your son told you that he wanted to take performance-enhancing drugs?
If we were put in that position where Luke, who's a college football player, came to me and said, either I'd like to try this or I am doing this, I would say that's a bad idea. I mean, you're a freshman in college. That's, you know, it might be a different conversation if you're in the NFL, but at this point in your life and in your career, not worth it.
I mean, that's bizarre. That's really bizarre. Don't dope now. You're only a freshman in college, but if you can make it to the pros, then we have a different conversation on our hands. If you can make it to the NFL, man, have at it. It's an incredible answer. After everything this guy's gone through, that's an amazing answer. And then how about this answer about Floyd Landis?
Hey, could be worse. I could be Floyd Landis.
What, living in Leadville?
Or waking up a piece of shit every day.
Is that what you think?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I know. I don't think it. I know it.
Wow. Nice work there, Lance. Showing your maturity there. Showing that you've learned from your mistakes and grown. You're in a glass house and you are hurling the biggest boulders every single day. And it seems like the only thing you can hang your hat on is that you're not Floyd Landis. It could be worse. I could be Landis. And wake up a piece of bleep every single day? And then he's asked, is that what you think? Oh, no, that's what I know. And there was more. There was Lance allegedly ratting out former teammate Tyler Hamilton for cheating after Hamilton joined a new team and beat Lance in a time trial. There was that. There was Lance looking to destroy Greg LeMond's business after LeMond had the audacity to question Lance's decision to work with a noted doping doctor. So again, it wasn't just that he would lash out at those who suggested that he was cheating, and he was. He was looking to destroy people, their careers, their brands, their business. There was Lance calling Emma O'Reilly horrible names after she came forward and told the truth about him in the sport. So when asked to look back on that, and what do you think? Lance chalks that up to just being an idiot who was angry. But see, that's not really enough, Lance. That's not good enough. You weren't just an idiot who was angry. You were more than that. I mean, I can keep going because so much of that documentary was so weird. Like, how about that part where he got really, really emotional about how Jan Ulrich was treated in Germany? How weird was that part? And then attempting to draw a parallel between how Ulrich was treated in Germany and how Lance has been treated in America. Like, you know, you've been treated the way you've been treated as a cheater and a liar because you cheated and you lied. And because you continue to be pissed that we don't get it, that people just don't get it, and that people will not welcome you back. After seeing that doc, I'm still not sure why it existed in the first place. As I said last week, if it was meant to be an image rehab, that didn't work. But it did show one thing. He desperately wants to be relevant again. He wants to be accepted again. He wants people just to move on and welcome him back. And probably the worst part about that for Lance is we have moved on. We just moved on without him. The general public doesn't really care about his explanations or excuses or partial apologies. The general public just really doesn't care about the guy at all. And that's got to eat at him.
This is going to sound terrible, but I am relevant. I am.
Tyler Hamilton, who I mentioned, was in that doc. He also came on this show back in 2011. Tyler Hamilton came on this show in 2011. And he told me on this show what it was like to be bullied by Lance.
You know, Lance found out from, the owner of the restaurant that I was at this restaurant, and he, you know, quickly came down with his posse down to the restaurant, and I had excused myself to use the restroom, and on my way back, he stuck his hand out and stopped me in my tracks, and there was Lance Armstrong, and he, it was not necessarily a very nice exchange. He had a lot of bad things to say to me, you know, a lot of F-bombs, and he threatened me. He said he's going to make my life a living hell, both in the courtroom and out of the courtroom. So, you know, that coming from Lance Armstrong, you know, meant a lot, so I took it pretty seriously.
I would, too. I mean, he also said, I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't have what I have right now had I accepted that deal or done this differently. I wouldn't change a thing. I can remember, and again, if you know this show and you listen to the show, Lance would come on the show quite a bit back in the day, and we had some really good interviews. Of course, a lot of this was predicated on a big lie. And yes, I bought in like a lot of people. But I do remember when the tenor changed and this information started to get out and the story was changing and the narrative was changing. So then did my take. And I remember getting an email from him. It was not the nicest email, where, and this is what he did. But like you said in the documentary, everyone who dopes lies. And he was so far down that road that in his mind, he had no choice but to come at people the way he did. But in coming at people the way he did, he was destroying people who were telling the truth. Who were telling the truth. Not destroying people who were slandering him or smearing him, but who were telling the truth. And that was Tyler Hamilton in 2011 on this show. We are joined by Rod Carew. Rod, it's a pleasure to have you on today. There's a lot that I want to talk to you about regarding your book and all the stories inside of it, including our shared connection to Conrad Ruland. But before we do that, Rod, how are you and the people around you doing right now in the middle of this pandemic?
Well, we're doing good, Jim. You know, I put a self-imposed quarantine in myself, you know, because of my immune system. So I've got to stay away from people. And I'm hanging in there.
Good to hear, Rod. I can appreciate that very much. Listen, there's a lot that we can cover, but there was a time in your life when maybe you weren't somebody who was looking to be in the spotlight or to make it about you, but your daughter Michelle changed all of that, and it feels like she is an enormous inspiration behind the book. If we were to go way back, you also write about growing up in Panama. What was life like for you growing up?
Miserable. To say the least. You know, I was an abused kid growing up, and it was a constant. And baseball was the only thing that took my mind away from it, because when I got out of the baseball field, I felt like I was at home, you know, that no one could touch me, you know, when I was out there. So it has done a lot for me in my life, so I appreciate that.
Rod Carew is joining us. He's got a new book out. Rod, not to belabor the point, but you just said it. It was a very difficult childhood. Your father was a violent man when you were a child. What was that like, and how much pain and fear did you have to deal with as a result of that?
Well, it was every day. You know, he either beat me or beat my mom. So we were the only two in the family that he took advantage of. But I think because I was a sick kid, you know, sickly kid when I was growing up, you know, I had rheumatic fever, and I spent about 9 months in the hospital, and he didn't think that I was going to amount to anything. You know, even though I loved baseball so much, he didn't think that I had the insides to make it, to go out there and play every day and make it.
Hall of Famer Rod Crew is joining us. Well, you found the sport. Well, you tell me, Rod, did you find baseball or did baseball find you? And what did you love so much about the game when you started?
Well, I actually was playing soccer. And my uncle, who was in charge of the physical education department at the school, saw me play baseball for the first time. And he said, okay, no more soccer. It's going to be baseball from here on in. So he took me under his wing and worked with me a lot and made sure that I enjoyed the game. And I told him, I says, yeah, I says, one of these days I want to leave this country and go to the United States and play baseball in front of 40,000 or 50,000 fans, like I hear them say on the Armed Forces Radio.
Rod Crew joining us, and that's exactly what you did. Now, you were playing ball, Rod, in New York. A scout saw you. The next time the Twins were in town to face the Yankees, they brought you to Yankee Stadium for a workout. What do you remember about that day?
Well, you know, it was the first day that I've been inside of Yankee Stadium. I used to play outside at the little ballparks that they had there, but I never went into to the stadium. I, you know, during the games that we played outside, sometimes the Yankees would be playing inside. And I used to think about hearing the crowds and, you know, every time someone might have hit a home run, Mantle or Maris or whoever. And I would say to myself, you know, one day I might be playing in this same house right here that Ruth built.
Rod Crew is a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He has an autobiography out right now. It's called One Tough Out, Fighting Off Life's Curveballs out, and the book is out right now, I should say. So, Rod, you said that one of the most memorable days of your career was June 26th, 1977. That was Rod Crew Jersey Day at Metropolitan Stadium. You had five hits. You scored five runs. You drove in six that day. How special a day was that?
Oh, it was a great day because I think we were playing the White Sox, and it seems like everything I hit found a hole. And, you know, I received, I think, six or seven standing ovations during the course of that game. And, you know, I appreciated the people standing and applauding me and having me come back out to dugout because, you know, they saw me come in there as a young kid, and all of a sudden I took over the charge of the ball club because Tony and Harmon had left. So now it was up to me to be the guy that whenever they need something, I was the one that was sent upstairs to Mr. Griffin.
Rod Crew is joining us. Now, Rod, the power of the book is that it's not just about your baseball career. It's about your life after baseball as well. As many people know, your daughter Michelle was diagnosed with leukemia as a teenager. Rod, personally, I'll never forget, my father was diagnosed with leukemia, and I'll never forget that conversation. What do you remember about hearing the diagnosis for the first time yourself regarding Michelle?
Well, you know, I knew nothing about leukemia. And then I started reading up the day that we found out about it. Then I went and I started reading up on it, and I learned a lot. I learned it's like a death sentence, you know, because at the time, not too many kids were being saved because not too many people were able to give, to donate, to keep kids alive. And so I got involved heavy, and the reason I did was because of Michelle. You know, she knew that I didn't talk to the press that much, and she told me, she said, Daddy, you've got to promise me, you know, after she watched all the kids in the hallways kicking the soccer balls and, you know, they're dragging their poles down the hallway trying to play hockey and stuff like that. She says, you know, Daddy, no matter what happens to me, you know, she says, I want you to help all these kids. And I know that to do that, you're going to have to talk to the press, and you have to promise me that that you'll do that. So I made a promise to her, and since then, that's all I do. I talk about the cancer kids, and I've had a golf tournament this would have been, I think, the 25th year, but we had to cancel out because of the pandemic. So I'm still there plugging away, trying to help kids, because it's so important. You know, I've saw so many families come through Children's Hospital in Orange County and lost their homes because they have to pay to try and keep their kids alive. So, you know, I was fortunate to have still been in the baseball system for insurance and stuff like that. So they handle everything for us and really made it easier on myself and on my wife and my other two daughters.
Rod Crew is joining us. Rod, I'm clearly aware everybody in the area knows how much work you've done with Chalk. We've also been involved, and there are amazing people that are working there, and I know they so appreciate the work that you've done. You're also an advocate for the American Heart Association. You suffered a heart attack in 2015, and then, Rod, this story is absolutely amazing. In 2016, you needed to receive a heart and kidney transplant. You received a transplant from Conrad Ruland, a former NFL player who had passed very young. What was it like when you received that call that you were going to receive a transplant?
Well, first of all, Jim, you know, I had met Conrad when he was, I think, 11 years old, because my son and daughter went to school there, same school that he was at, and I was there for a basketball game, and he was out running around, you know, playing and stuff, and then he came up to me and he said, "You're Rod Carew, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "When I grow up, I want to be an athlete just like you." I said, "Yeah, but the first thing you have to do is get good grades in school. Don't forget your schoolwork." He said, "Oh, no, I'm a good student, and you know, but I'm going to be an athlete." I says, "Okay." And sure enough, this little boy grew up to be, I don't know, 6'6", or something like that, and signed and played with the Jets. And then he played with the Ravens, and during, you know, he was waiting for a contract to possibly sign with the New England Patriots when he was working out, and then he had an aneurysm, and the story goes on from there that he was the kid that saved my life. I was able to get a heart from him, get a kidney from him, and so I got rid of that Volkswagen that was in me, and now I have a Maserati pumping and, you know, giving me a lot more life to live.
Oh, it's incredible. It's an amazing story. You met him as an 11-year-old, and then he had this tragic passing. He was an amazing person. My family knew Conrad a little bit because my wife and my kids worked out the same gym, and he was such an amazing guy. His family reached out and said they feel like they're a part of your family now. What does that mean to you? Rod, is there any way to put all of this into words even?
You know, my friend upstairs, I think he stepped in and he said, "I'm going to keep you around for a little bit longer because you've been doing such good work trying to help people." And that, my good friend, is God. So, you know, I had faith in him. And, you know, I told Rhonda, I told my wife, I says, "Honey, if anything goes wrong, you know," I says, "I'm not afraid to die." I says, "You know, I will go home with my father, and he'll continue taking care of me." But the family, you know, we became close to the family right away. I went over after I got out of the hospital. I went over to the family's home, and his mom wanted to put her head on my chest and listen to his heartbeat. And I know what that's like, you know, losing a daughter and the family losing a son. I knew what it was like. And, you know, I had to hold back tears because, you know, I knew what she was doing was very important to her and to her husband. So we had a nice day, nice dinner. And we became the Carulins. And wherever we went, we went as a foursome to try and get the word out, you know, to people to get their hearts checked and don't wait. And if they feel something, go to the doctors right away, because that's what I did. You know, we had a leukemia lymphoma walk Saturday night at Angel Stadium. And so Sunday morning, I got up and I said, I think I'm going to go, you know, just play nine holes and just practice. And this was at 5:30 in the morning. My wife didn't even know that I left the house. And so when I hit the first, when I got there, I was the only person out on the course that day. And, you know, it's not a big fancy course. It's a small course that people can go out and work on their game and stuff. And so the first ball that I hit went straight down the middle. And I was surprised because usually I have a little slice or a little cut,
right?
You know, in my drives. So as I'm putting my club back in my bag, I felt this burn in the top of my chest, like a indigestion burn. Then my hand started to get, you know, clammy. And I remember what this friend of mine had told me, that, you know, he was in Vegas and he was playing the craps, and he felt something funny in his chest. Picked up his money, went up to see the doctor. They sent him to the hospital, and he had, like, I don't know, 95% blockage.
Mm.
And when he got home, he was able to take care of it. So
right.
I remember that, and I backed my cart right back to the clubhouse. I was on the first hole, and I walked in and I asked the lady if she could please call the paramedics. Now, she was just opening the club, and there's a 14-year-old kid that was helping her, and he got a little upset because she hadn't gotten on the phone to call the paramedics.
In Oregon, Chris. It's good to have you, Chris. How are you?
Hey, Jim. Thanks for the call, and great topic, and you're doing an awesome job. I have 14 years in law enforcement, and just wanted to speak on the officer involved. He violated the first two things that he was sworn to do, serve and protect. We're there to make sure that we preserve life and do what's right and enforce the laws. The other three officers, as far as I'm concerned, when they were standing there, they should all be prosecuted as attempted murder because they did nothing as well.
All right, Chris, I appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much. That's a former police officer. Let's go to Santa Barbara. John Wesley in Santa Barbara. John Wesley, nice to have you. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
As you know, Jim, I live actually in Goleta, which is close to Isla Vista, to where you went to school. And there are not a lot of black people here. And I'm actually from England. And I'm actually half American and half British. And I spend a lot of time both in both places. And as you know, there's not, like I said, there's not a lot of black people here. But I'm very happy to see that there are people who are not brown or people of color who are coming, who are stepping up here in this county, in this town, to speak out against the protest, against the police and what they've done. And I just want to call and give props to those people who have gotten the backs of black people and who are more oriented solutions than to blame the looters. And I've often said that if it's come to the point that people are rioting and people are looting, it's because they aren't being heard. And I'm just really heartened to see that there are people who are of not people of color who have stepped up and done the right thing in this situation. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, John Wesley. I appreciate that. Let's go to Idaho this time. Carla in Idaho. Hi, Carla. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
I want to thank you for having this conversation. This has been something that I've been kind of really crying over quite a bit here lately. I am a white woman, and I have to deal with my own biases. And I'm also a teacher. And teachers in particular, we've been blamed or are told that we have biases in the classroom, and that's something that we need to be aware of. And something that we are teaching currently right now is having a growth mindset. And that's something that our whole nation, I think, needs to have. And there's the, we talk about the power of yet. A kid might say, I can't read this, or I can't do this math problem. And we'll say, you can't yet. And that's something that the nation needs to hear. We may not be there yet, but if we all say, I'm willing to work towards having a new mindset in the way I see people of different color than myself, and we say yet, and I'm willing to be a listener and not get fragile as a white person and boo-hoo, I'm horrible and all of that, then we can hopefully get over the prejudice and the bias that has been in our nation far too long.
I appreciate your thoughts too, Carla. Thanks so much. Nashville. Kenny in Nashville. Thanks for your patience.
Mr.
Kenny, how are you?
I knew you wouldn't run from this issue. And I tell you, I've listened to you for years. Never call. You can tell I don't have a radio voice, but this is so passionate to me. I graduated got my master's in criminology about 40 years ago, nearly 40 years ago. And that was the age of police enlightenment. And the big thing was that to address the issue of us against them mentality and police forcing. And unfortunately, it's still alive today. The problem is that's the only profession where the people with the least amount of knowledge and experience have the most discretion. And it's always been a problem. And I was hopeful 40 years ago when I was getting my degree that we would bring a change. But unfortunately, it just hadn't happened yet. And it's just heartbreaking. And that's all I have to say. And I love your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny, very much. Kenny in Nashville. It is heartbreaking. Let's go to Orange County. Odie in Orange County. Hi, Odie. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing excellent, Jim. Thanks for the call. First time, very long time. I've been listening to you since you were in that shack on Pacific Highway in San Diego. And I wanted to touch on the things that have been happening recently and the change that needs to be made. And some people aren't aware of this, but I've got a spouse that's in municipal HR, does some arbitration decision writing for law enforcement cases and things like that. And the things that need to be addressed, you know, they need to hold municipal HR departments accountable for their hiring practices and their hirings of officers, especially those that create instances like this. They need to look at the progressive discipline and the relationship with police unions and things like that. You know, that's what can help to solve the problem, you know. And I just want to thank you for the courage to take your program where you're taking it today. And warm Maggiano's in Costa Mesa, and I'm out.
All right, Odie, thank you very much. Let's go to Santa Monica. Paul in Santa Monica. I've got time for your telephone calls. We continue right now. It's good to have you, Paul. How are you?
I'm well, Jim. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call because I just find it comforting that you're always on the air after something like this happens. I live three blocks from where that car was burning last night. The Starbucks on the corner was vandalized. There's people protecting their businesses with AK-47s and AR-15s on their roof. And it was just really surreal. And this was after going down to Colorado and Ocean, the protest, which could not have been more peaceful, mild. I mean, there were prayers and 2 minutes and 53 seconds of silence. The police, you know, were respectful. There was a line of like older ladies that stood between the police and protesters, so it wouldn't get out of hand. I mean, that's how together it was and how it felt so right that, you know, that happened. And then you cut to
I left at about 1:45, and I just went down on my bicycle. Rode by the 3rd Street Promenade, and it was shut down. You know, there was just police cars, like, on every block, making sure that people didn't go in there. And there was already a first report that the Nike store had gotten broken into. And it's a very upscale, that Jordan 23 store.
Yep.
And, I mean, within 2 hours, it just went nuts. But, I don't know if it was some of the same people, but I just don't equate the two things. I really believe that there were people coming that were, you know, on the backs of the protesters, like using that as cover for their nefarious, thievery. And when I woke up this morning, I looked forward to hearing you. I just want to thank you for, I've been a listener since the Mighty 690, and, some of your listeners will get over it. There's no sports to talk about anyway. We want to talk about the 73 Mets versus Phillies game. I just want to say thank you. Sorry for going on, but no, I really do appreciate your career.
No, I appreciate it, Paul. Thanks so much. And I appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And I know you're right in the middle of it. Ross in Arkansas. Nice to have you on the show, Ross. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing today, Ron?
Good.
Well, I'm angry down here. I mean, I think we're all a little angry, but as I sit and I think about this, and I look at my family, and I look around, and I see my brothers and my sisters all over this country, we're all facing a problem right now of ignorance and uneducation. We're not talking about the things we need to talk about, and I'm talking about the police officers, too. So I watch police officers shoot tear gas at reporters and at people in my own city, in my own state, and in my own country, because we're scared of each other. This division that's been created, the police officers need the education too. They should be demanding more training. I mean, they have to look at what's going on. We all have to look at what's going on. We're not teaching each other about how we've stolen histories from each other. We've stolen whole entire cultures from each other. And this is what we have now. And this division is only going to continue to make it worse and worse. And what I'd like to tell everybody is go home. Talk to your kids. Talk to your teachers. Talk to your preachers. Talk to anybody. But start talking. Stop burying this under the rug. And that's all I got, Ron. Thank you for doing this today.
Thank you, Ross. Thank you very much. Let's go to Northern California. Russell in Northern California. Nice to have you, Russell. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Thanks for listening to me. I thank you for using your platform to speak on this matter. I am a black man here in the Bay Area. I was raised in Oakland. I have two grown sons. One is 23. One is 18. Since they was 10 years old, I had to have that conversation with them of interaction with police. Unfortunately, this time last year, now these things that have been going on with police brutality and just random white folks hunting down and murdering black men didn't just pop up. They have been ongoing, and it is an environment that is introduced and fed and fertilized to manifest and grow into our society. Case in point, last year of March, my youngest son was about to start baseball in high school, graduate, and some clowns, some terrorists in his class, four of them, racially attacked him. It was a hate crime. It was swastikas. It was penises. Reference to his name and his sport that he plays. And instead of those four terrorists who sat in the class with my son being charged with a hate crime, they were slapped on the wrist with vandalism, given 5 days vacation from school, and then allowed to graduate early. They never received any kind of punishment. There was never no documentation. So now three of them are in the United States military. More than likely, they'll go into law enforcement. One of the terrorists that did this to my son, his father is a full-blown colonel in the United States military. They got away with a slap on the wrist. The school did nothing. They tried to cover it up. I had to get rid of the superintendent. The police department here in Fairfield did nothing. I had to get rid of the police chief. The DA told me, my wife, and Dr. Amos Brown of the NAACP that the swastika was not an image of hate, so therefore there was nothing they could do. This is how things manifest. And then we wonder why we see these images play out, play out, play out. Just like the gentleman said earlier, you know, it's okay. You have that smirk, like Steven Jackson said. You got that smirk because you're covered up. I'm protected. I'm privileged. I can do this. And
also,
I will
jump in, and I'm sorry to do so. I'm at the end of the hour, but I want to make sure I gave you as much time as I possibly could. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska. Steve in Omaha. Nice to have you on the show. Steve, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Jim. And I first want to say thank you for all the things that you said in the beginning of the show and the things you're saying now. I'm an African-American male. I have 6 children, and 3 of them are African-American boys. And like yourself, being a father, there is a point in age where your sons are able to drive. And there's things that we all worry about as parents. We worry about them, you know, speeding tickets or rolling the whip or, God forbid, dying in a car accident. But see, I have that pressure of worrying about my sons dying in a traffic stop because they fit the description. And it's an everyday fear. It's an everyday fear. And you know what drives me crazy? Like, I'm 50 years old, Jim. This isn't 1960. This is 2020. I shouldn't have to feel this way. The constant fear that my sons, who are all college graduates, who've never committed crimes, who always lend helping hands when people ask for them, good boys. But you know what? The color of their skin make them a person that automatically fits the description of some made-up crime that happens, and it scares me. And I used to be a cop, so I'm not here to say all cops are bad. I never would make that, you know, never make that distinction, because most of the cops I work with, we went to work and we wanted to do our job and go home during the day. And so I think there are good cops out there, but where are those good cops when these things are happening all the time? And I don't mean to ramble. I just want to get that off my chest. Thank you so much to you and your crew for this day, because I spent the weekend with tears in my eyes. Because my heart hurts, man, and so I appreciate what you're doing. And thank you, and all the clones. You guys, we got to come together, because if we don't make this a better place for our kids and our kids' kids, this place is going to burn to the ground, and we don't want that. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Steve. Let's go to Chapel Hill. Tobin joins us. Hey, Tobin, how are you?
Hey, thanks, Rome. I'm pretty good, I guess. Yeah, right. So let's get on Twitter or social and start hurling hate at Rome, of all people. Isn't that emblematic of our problem, really, in general, right? So I just wanted to thank you, because that first segment, you're open, and then the very first phone call from Rob in Oakland was the best radio that I've ever heard, ever. And I guess it's a little recency bias, and I might be overreacting. But, you know, I am so tired of the same things happening in this country over and over and over, and people would rather circle the wagons and hate than actually act. So people really like you because you are clear and you use a lot of common sense no matter what you're talking about. And I really appreciate what you're doing, because you have a Hall of Fame radio platform to go with it. And I'm using this just for a few moments to echo what you and people like Rob have been saying, that we have problems that go far beyond politics and pandemics, and we need to start paying attention and start acting instead of hating. And thank you for helping us do this. And Rome, I'm getting tired of these serious phone calls, man, but you know, you're doing what you do, and thank God that you're doing it. Out.
All right, Tobin, thank you very much. As I mentioned when I started the program, this was not going to be an easy day. This was not going to be a pleasant program. Some of you were going to be upset enough to say things like, hey, Rome, I've had your back. Hey, Rome, I've listened to you for 20 years. Never again. Goodbye, Rome. And I knew this. And certainly, I don't want to lose a 20-year listener. However, I want to get it right. Rob in Oakland. Nice to have you on the show, Rob. How are you?
Man, I'm doing good, Rome. I'm at work, and I just had to hit you up, bro, and give you your proper due, man. I've already had mad respect for you, brother. The fact that you going this way, bro, you are the dopest dude on the block. And also on everything I love, man. I appreciate you so much for speaking out. Using your platform, bro, to speak on this is so dope to me, bro. And I appreciate you, man. Obviously, I'm a black man. I live in Oakland, California. I'm a 6'6 guy. And every single day, bro, it's like I hope I can make it home. I don't get in my car unless my wallet is on the dash. You know what I mean? And it's like one of those things. If I get pulled over, like I have gotten pulled over, you know, in the midst of all of this stuff that goes on. And first thing I say to the police officer, man, you know, when he gives me directions or whatever, it's like, man, are you sure it's okay for me to reach for my wallet? Is it sure? Are you sure it's okay for me to, you know, put my hands up or whatever? Are you absolutely sure? You know what I mean? This is the kind of stuff that we live with on a daily basis. I got a 16-year-old son. He's bigger than me. He's like 6'8". You know what I mean? And I fear that, you know, something like that would happen to him. You know, you never know. So I'm always coaching him up when stuff like this happens, man. So that's my experience, man. I just wanted to let you know I love you. This is dope to me, bro, the fact that you're doing this, and I appreciate you, Jim Rob.
I appreciate you too, Rob. Thank you very much.
Good night,